Next case for argument, United States v. Fuller. Ms. Sonneborn.
May it please the Court, my name is Amanda Sonneborn and I'm appointing counsel here today on behalf of the appellant Montez Fuller. The issues before you are clear. The questions are, was Mr. Fuller's rights under the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution to a speedy trial violated, and was his right to a speedy trial under the Speedy Trial Act violated? The answer to both of those questions is yes. A defendant's right to a speedy trial is not something to be manipulated and left to the whims of the prosecution. Indeed, as the U.S. Constitution clearly guarantees all defendants the right to a quick and speedy trial before the public. In fact, Congress went so far as to bolster this position by passing the Speedy Trial Act and further guaranteeing that right. Mr. Fuller, instead of having a speedy trial, had quite the opposite. He sat in custody for over 14 months, never once moving to extend the trial himself, never once otherwise doing anything to delay the trial himself, waiting for trial. He raised his point regarding his request for a speedy trial once orally in front of the court, and then he made a formal motion. Both times the court denied his request. It's quite remarkable that Mr. Fuller's position in terms of not requesting an extension of any time, given the fact that he had two different appointed counsel during the course of his hearing and a wholly different person who originally represented him at the arraignment. The government in this case...
He had someone representing at arraignment and then two
different separate ones.
Two subsequent attorneys?
Correct. And never once did he ask for a continuance. He constantly pushed the case to go forward. The government in this case has suggested that there are various reasons to explain these delays, focusing mostly on the requested delays of his co-defendants and the delays in indicting his co-defendants. Under the Sixth Amendment, though, Mr. Fuller's rights objectively were violated given the 14-month delay. First of all, it obviously meets the first prong of the Barker v. Wingo test in that it was over a year in delay between when he was originally arrested and when he went to court. Second of all, the government here is more to blame for the delay than Mr. Fuller. The government requested two separate extensions of time. As I said, Mr. Fuller never requested an extension of time.
Yeah, but the only solution to this is to not be tried with co-defendants.
And
it's a fact of life when you all invite the same crime, they're going to be tried together, and this is the problem here. The government had very minimal amount of time that it extended.
But in this particular instance, the government did stagger the indictments of the co-defendants. So, for example,
you're accusing them of abusing the system then of some kind.
Indeed, Your Honor.
But that's the problem. We're not. I guess what we're addressing is not the fact that these weren't correctly extended. It's that you're alleging the government just stretched all this out for no good reason.
Under the Sixth Amendment, I'm arguing that yes, they were overly extended and they manipulated the system to delay Mr. Fuller's trial, and that Mr. Fuller suffered a prejudice as a result of those delays and that government manipulation, and that the Sixth Amendment is designed to prohibit that type of manipulation. And indeed, if the government can stagger indictments, can continue to add new defendants, can play games with when they plead individuals out who are co-defendants, that essentially that right becomes null. Because they could delay that process for years and years, causing great prejudice to the one person who ultimately gets tried, who causes no delay of his own, and that's what happened in this case.
Well, what is the prejudice?
Mr. Fuller, there was one particular witness who was not identified at the beginning, and had the case gone to trial, that positive identification of Mr. Fuller would not likely have been made because it wasn't until over a year later when that person positively identified him out of a lineup.
So the real pain to him was the truth caught up with him.
There was also additional prejudice to Mr. Fuller in the regard that he...
Well, that's not precisely the prejudice they had in mind when they wrote
it. Well, In this instance, there was coverage of Mr. Fuller, of these particular bank robberies in the St. Louis area, and it's unclear that that particular witness would have been able to identify him had not that delay in time and the presentation of the witness, of Mr. Fuller's face on the TV screen in the St. Louis area, if that would have occurred.
Hasn't Judge Bauer raised an important question? If the, quote, prejudice, close quote, consists simply of the fact that more evidence has come to light, that's no reason to let a defendant off. It's when evidence favorable to him has faded, you know, because of lapse of time. That's the sort of prejudice we're concerned about, isn't it?
Your Honor, there was other types of prejudice that the Supreme Court identified in Barker, including the anxiety level for the individual who's being forced to be incarcerated, the time that they're forced to stay in prison, obviously away from, or in jail, away from their family and their friends.
Well, that's deducted when they're sentenced, right?
Yes.
So what's the prejudice?
Your Honor, as I indicated originally, that the prejudice here that Mr. Fuller suffered was from both the identification and his continuing to have to stay in the local county jail.
I don't understand you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Get it. just more evidence comes to light. That's not prejudice. That's not interfering with a trial that reaches a correct result. And the second type, the fact that he doesn't like being in jail, well, but any time he spends in jail awaiting trial will be deducted from his prison sentence. So how is he worse off?
I understand your question, Your Honor. I think the Supreme Court acknowledged, though, in Barker, that those were considerations of, in the prejudice.
But that doesn't make any sense. Yeah, because it doesn't make any sense, right?
With all due respect, that was one of the factors the Supreme Court said, and they said that all four of the factors also have to be weighed under the Barker test, i.e. the length of time, the delay, who is to blame for the delay, and whether or not the defendant raised his complaints thoroughly prior to adjudication before the court. And Mr. Fuller complied with all four of those components in this case. And repeatedly asserted his rights.
What he to do? I go back to what I said earlier. Is he supposed to demand being tried by himself now, and not have all these people keep trickling into the case? More evidence comes in, more difficult to win. Is that what you're saying? That this whole process shouldn't be permitted?
Your Honor, in this particular instance, we're saying that the government used that process to manipulate
the
ends.
Well, yeah, but it's legal. It's legal. Should there be a separate rule or something that he can demand, I want to be tried now?
Sure. Indeed, that is what Mr. Fuller's position is, that he shouldn't have to wait around for the government to manipulate the system in terms of dealing with his co-defendants, that he requested a trial quickly and that he was not given the right to that trial quickly as he was guaranteed under the Sixth Amendment and the Speedy Trial Act.
It's a good position.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Onnemoren. Ms. Gorovsky?
May it please the Court. There was no error in this case, statutory or constitutional. There was no manipulation of the system, and there's absolutely no evidence that there was any attempt to manipulate the system. Under the statutory calculation of the speedy trial clock, approximately 6 days total ran on the speedy trial clock. You start with the initial appearance of the last co-defendant, although the appellant argues that we shouldn't do that. That's what the law states. We start with the initial appearance of the last co-defendant to be indicted. Unfortunately, I would suggest if he didn't like it, he should have committed his crime alone. But he didn't. He committed his crime with co-defendants. They were tried. And the initial appearance of that last co-defendant happened on January 16, 2007. There had been a previous continuance by another co-defendant, which told the time to the next trial date on May 15, 2007. There was a valid ends of justice finding on that continuance. And again, there was another continuance by a co-defendant that continued it to August 21, 2007. Although the government did file a continuance and received a 6-day continuance from the August 21st date to the August 27th date. There was no valid ends of justice finding, and the government concedes those 6 days count on the speedy trial clock. Again, as I said, appellant's argument that the last co-defendant's initial appearance should not count is just simply not supported by any law. There was no motion to sever filed by appellant, and his argument that the government had the knowledge to charge that co-defendant at the time of the original indictment is simply baseless. Your Honors, and their basis on 3161B for that interpretation is a misinterpretation of 3161B, which says that a defendant needs to be charged within 30 days of arrest, not within 30 days of government knowledge, which even if it did say within government knowledge, there's no way the defense can say that the government had knowledge because the case was still under investigation. And the law is clear. The clock starts with the initial appearance of the last co-defendant. The appellant cites to the United States versus Van Brandy, which has no effect on this case. The Seventh Circuit has not adopted the case, but even if it had, the government did not wait until the eve of trial to file the superseding indictment charging the last co-defendant. It didn't affect the appellant's charges in any way. He was not affected by the superseding indictment substantially in terms of charges. And even if the government needed a valid reason, which is what Van Brandy says, the government would need Van Brandy says the government would need a valid reason to file a superseding on the eve of trial other than just to stop the speedy trial clock. Well, in this case, Your Honors, I would state, as I said, the government needed that further time for investigation of that co-defendant. There were other co-defendants who were talking, and the government needed that time to file before we filed the superseding indictment. The appellant makes a spirit of the law argument in their brief. The government asserts that it's the Sixth Amendment that is the spirit of the law, so there should not necessarily be a third spirit of the law argument. But the gist of their argument in that sense is that incarceration in state custody for 2 months prior to the incarceration in federal custody should count against his speedy trial clock. But, Your Honors, this court has stated before, arrest by the state on state charges does not start the speedy trial clock. There is no ruse in this case, even if we are talking about the spirit of the law. There's no ruse by the federal government in this case to avoid the speedy trial clock. There's nothing in any way in this case to show any sense of government manipulation here. Lastly, under the Sixth Amendment, it's the Barker v. Wingo test. The length of the day delay, yes, 1 year in custody does trigger review under the test, but it's not excessive. The reason for the delay is neutral because of co-defendant continuances, and the assertion of the right came very late. It came in April, which was 8 months after the defendant's initial appearance, and that was orally. In writing, it did not come until July, which was 3 months later. And the most important factor, Your Honors, is prejudice. And the defendant was incarcerated pretrial, but as this court has already pointed out, he receives credit for that time when he's sentenced. The conclusory claim of anxiety while in custody really doesn't show very much. It's just a conclusory claim of anxiety with no support. There is no impairment to the defense whatsoever. The government's ability to better prepare for their case is not a prejudice to the defendant. The defendant's case was not hampered in any way. There's no evidence that he sought to present some evidence that he was not able to present in that year. And there's no evidence whatsoever, even if we were to look at the government's preparation of the government's case in terms of that witness identification, which appellant says was in the media. There were motions regarding that, and there's no evidence whatsoever that that witness identified the defendant because of media attention. So if there are no further questions, I would ask for an affirmance.
Thank you, Ms. Skorevsky. So, Ms. Sonneborn, how much time does she have? 1, 2 minutes?
Two quick points, Your Honor. First of all, as to the issue of whether or not co-defendant delays and requests are attachable to the to Mr. Fuller, the statute says that co-defendant delays and requests for continuance should be attached or counted against Mr. Fuller's clock if they are reasonable. And we would submit that in this instance they were not reasonable to attach those delays to Mr. Fuller. Similarly, as to the government's argument regarding whether or not the state and the federal government were working together in connection with Mr. Fuller, Mr. Fuller was arrested by U.S. Marshals and then held in state custody for 2 months. We would argue that that certainly is evidence that, given the later indictment on federal bank robbery charges, that they were working together, and therefore those 2 months should count when considering whether or not he was held for an unreasonably long period of time. And for all those reasons, his conviction should be confirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sonneborn, and thank you for accepting the appointment and for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client. And we thank Ms. Gorupski as well.